Is this good? My microphone level? It's good? Cool. Hi, I'm Juliet. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful, recovering alcoholic. It's really great to be at this meeting, mostly because I recognize almost none of you, which means all sorts of new people have come in and started coming to this meeting. I used to come here a long time ago when we were in a different space altogether, and it's such a special meeting, never had a legal drink. I was not met with a lot of prejudice for coming into AA so young when I came into the rooms. I was actually met with a lot of love and acceptance, but I was met with a lot of prejudice from my own family, actually. A lot of people saying, you couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, you're too young, that's ridiculous. So even then, just having a place to come where there was like a real collection of young people who decided that they had a drinking problem before they even turned the legal age to drink, it was a really big deal. My sobriety date is February 7th. I can remember it for a second. I'm like, it's February 11th? It's February 7th. It's February 7th, 2005, which means hopefully this February, you know, if I don't get hammered over the holidays, you know, I'll... which is quite likely, I don't feel like drinking today. I'll be coming up on 12 years sober. I first came in to these rooms in 2001 when I had just turned 20. So I spent a lot of, so I got sober eventually when I was 20, I guess I just turned, was about to turn 24. And I sometimes think I need to write out the timeline of when everything happened because I'm always wrong about how old I was or, but I know what the years were. It was August 11th, 2001, the first time I came to a meeting, and it was February 7th, 2005, when I finally surrendered and got sober and stayed sober. But I grew up in New York City. I was an Upper West Side kid, and I definitely had a complicated family and youth, as I think a lot of us do who come in young, and I don't ever blame that experience for my drinking. The fact that my parents are both adult children of alcoholics, codependent, bizarre people who did a lot of very strange things that are objectionable and potentially criminal. You know, I don't blame that for my drinking. I just think it inflamed like a pre-existing condition. I think it gave me a reason to try to escape at a much earlier age than maybe the average person. And since I started, I started drinking liquor at the age of 12, then that sparked my like biological disease that I believe that I have a disease of alcoholism that is genetic, that I can't avoid. Both of my grandfathers were alcoholics and rageaholics, brothers, cousins. I mean, there's just so much alcoholism and mental illness in my family. And sometimes they're really hard to parcel out and tell which is which. Sometimes they really bleed into each other. But for me, it's just clear that I am incapable of stopping drinking because of the chemistry inside of me. But I had plenty of reasons to want to escape my home, my life, my feelings at an early age. So those things like really worked against each other and turned me into like a very angsty, early, intense maintenance drinker, where by the time I was 14 years old, I went to school on the Upper West Side, about 8 blocks from where I lived, and I would sneak my parents' liquor cabinet, which they never used other than for parties. Neither of them drank because they both had alcoholic fathers, so they never drank. They were just like insane codependents, and they had all their other addictions. They had a fantastic range of addictions that didn't involve technical substance abuse, so it was never really diagnosed for them. But I would sneak into their liquor cabinet and I would pour vodka into a Poland Spring bottle, and I would pour this crazy old bottle of Wild Turkey that they had that I think that was like my great grandfather's. I mean, this is an old giant bottle of Wild Turkey that I would pour into an Arizona iced tea bottle. And I would cut them with a little bit of water, and I would put them in my purple JanSport backpack with my initials on it, and I'd walk the 8 blocks up Columbus Avenue to 7th grade. And I would nip in the bathroom, because even though the first couple of times that I drank, I got hammered, I puked on myself, and then I did it again the next day. You know, like, that to me, I mean, the fact that I became so sick the first few times I drank, it didn't affect me at all, but it was very clear. I was like, oh my God, liquor alters how I feel, and this is wonderful. I was very nervous. I was very uncomfortable. Even though I was like a very social, happy, creative kid, I had so much anxiety at such an early age about so many things that the idea of alcohol slowed down that like obsessive role of thinking that I had in my mind already by the time I was seven. Like, what are they thinking? What are they doing? What are they thinking about me? Are you talking about me? Are you talking about me right now? What's happening? Do you look at me? How's my dress? Are you thinking? Like, it's just like this constant anxiety role. And when I drank, I didn't have to feel that. I felt this very warm sensation like flowing through me, and I was very comfortable. But I was so smart at 14 that I knew that getting hammered every day was like a huge mistake because I'd get caught and be taken away from me. So I was already a maintenance drinker. Like, I was just nipping little shots in between social studies and art class and gym because I just wanted to keep that warm, like, kind of suspension of reality in my system. And of course that escalated into doing enormous amounts of drugs at a very early age. By the time I was 15, I was stealing hundreds of dollars a week from my parents and buying tons of cocaine, ecstasy, acid, mushrooms. I didn't like pot because it mellowed me out too much. Like, I don't know how to explain that. I wasn't good at smoking pot, even though I did it all the time anyway. I just did so many drugs and I drank so much liquor, and even when friends of mine would have parties and everybody would be drinking, I'm a little older than you guys, so I don't think you've ever even heard of Zima. But we would drink Zima and wine. Some of you have heard of Zima, you know? But Zima and wine coolers, like when friends' parents would go out of town. But then I would have like a flask of bourbon that I would go secretly drink in the bathroom because I wanted to be on par with all of my friends and I wanted to feel social with them. And I didn't want them to know that I just needed to like hit it that much harder to like take away the pain. It was a little too dramatic for like my, you know, eighth grade friends even. You know, like I was a lot, and I handled it by just drinking a little too much. So I got into a lot of trouble. I would sneak out of the house on school nights regularly and take a cab down to the tunnel and like the limelight, and I would like party all night in club clothes with strangers, and then I would sneak back into my pink bedroom. You know, it was just a really ridiculous experience that I had, and somehow nobody noticed. I just got away with it until friends of mine actually conducted. And the fact that nobody noticed is a big subject in my life, but like I'm just gonna put that on the shelf for now, you know? And actually two really good friends of mine called my parents and said that they wanted to do, people who had done drugs with me, like people who were drinking themselves, like these were kids who were out partying with me, and they were like, holy crap, we're afraid she's gonna die. So they called my parents and staged an intervention. During which I screamed and yelled and kicked my two dearest friends, who I have not really seen since. I mean, at the time, they were my dearest friends. Not seen them since. I kicked them out of the house, and I said, you guys are such assholes. I am going to get sober just to show... It was about cocaine. They were scared about the cocaine, but they were like, you know, I'm going to get sober just to show you assholes that, like, after a year sober, I'm still going to tell you that you did the wrong thing and you were such dicks for doing this to me. Like, I was really, you know, it was so ridiculous, like, the way I yelled at them and kicked them out of the house. And I made these big promises, and I went off to boarding school, and I kept none of the promises, and I kept doing drugs, and I snuck in liters of bourbon into the school, and I just somehow made my way. I drank myself into, like, a 1.9 average my junior year. But then so... On the flip side of being this totally disengaged kid who was like drinking tons of liquor, doing tons of drugs, I had this sense in me, even from when I was like 5 years old, this desperation to be good. I just wanted to be good. I wanted to do good work. I wanted to do good things. I wanted to help people. I wanted to be kind. But I had no idea how. Like, one of my favorite things about Alcoholics Anonymous is that when I got here, I got re-raised by the people I met in AA to be like a decent human being. And I didn't know until I came into AA and to working for years with sponsors, becoming friends with people who'd been sober for a while, you know, trudging the road with friends who, you know, we got sober together and slowly like learned, like through getting knocked down and picking ourselves back up together. Like, I learned how to be a human being who said what I meant what I said, didn't lie, you know, had, you know, like did the, like had intentions to do good. And if I didn't, like made amends for that. Like I honestly didn't know how to live like that until I got to AA. I think why is a different story altogether, but I was just in a total blur. And so when I woke up and I had done terribly in school at the end of my junior year, I was just like, no, this is all wrong. And I went to the school dean and I begged. I was like, this was a very fancy like prep school in New England. And it was like, and I was like, can I please just do that again? Can I, she was like, no, you've done well enough to go forward and graduate. I was like, but no, it's not good enough. I want to do better. I want to do it again. And they thought that I was crazy, and I fought and I kicked to like do it again. And I kind of sobered myself up for the next year, and I got really great grades and like ended up being able to go to college and blah, blah, you know. But it was just bizarre that like after years of being blanked out, I suddenly decided like I wanted to do good, and then I could if I just like white knuckled it like a crazy person. And I took a year off in between high school and college to move to San Francisco and work for some human rights organizations. And once I was there and I was by myself, I bottomed out really hard. I was just alone. There were no dorm parents. There were no parents. There were no teachers. And it was just very simple. It wasn't like anything happened. It just, without any supervision or structure, I just started drinking at 6 o'clock in the morning every day. I was living in a sublet with other 20-somethings. I was 19, other 20-somethings, and I would show up to this not-for-profit I was working at. I had a job bagging groceries at a food co-op in Noe Valley in San Francisco. I was doing a whole bunch of things, and like I got there and I was like so excited. And I was like, I quit drinking on the plane, and I quit smoking cigarettes on the plane, and I was like, I'm gonna be awesome, and I'm gonna do everything good, and I'm gonna be this bright, shiny person that I haven't been capable of being all this time, even though I fantasized about it. And within like 3 months of being there, just like the kind of like gusto behind my decision to change who I was wore off. And I started waking up every morning with a bottle of Maker's Mark, and I had it in the shower. And I drank while I was in the shower at 7 a.m. I drank out of a flask at 11 a.m. I took bumps in the bathroom. I drank out of a flask at 5 p.m. And then I would go to a bar and I would drink until I passed out at home or somewhere else. And I woke up the next morning and started again. And by the end of that year, I was incapable of holding down food. I really just became like a sick, sad, like alcoholic. I couldn't not drink. At a certain point, I stopped drinking water altogether. I just was like, with the freedom to drink the way I wanted without any supervision. There were so many feelings, and I can't even remember what they were now. Like I hated myself. I was afraid of people. I had all these ambitions and didn't believe for a second I could accomplish them. And I just couldn't stop pouring liquor down my throat every day. And so I couldn't hold down food. And I kept vomiting about 20 minutes later after every time I tried to eat something. And I couldn't figure out why. And here's a great example of like the denial of the alcoholic. I was like, why can't I hold down food? Why am I vomiting 5 times a day? Why have I lost 30 pounds in the past 6 months? Like I couldn't figure it out. And I actually paid out of pocket to see like multiple naturopaths to figure out why I couldn't stop vomiting. I started taking like aerobics classes. I was like, maybe I'm not healthy enough. It was insane. Like it never occurred to me that the liter of bourbon I was drinking every day was affecting me. Like the delusional thinking of the active alcoholic it's insipid. Like I was an intelligent person and it didn't occur to me for a second that that's what was going on. And they even x-rayed my esophagus to see if like something, and nobody ever thought to ask if I was drinking. Honestly, the end of that story is that I woke up one day in an alley in Cuernavaca, Mexico, at 11 o'clock in the morning with the sun beating down on me, having had some really scary experiences for the 48 hours previous. And I finally had the fear in me that I was going to die. I was like, holy shit, I'm going to die. Like, I can't believe I still have all of my organs waking up in this situation. And I found a payphone, and I was totally delusional, and I called home, I called my parents back in New York, and I told my dad, and it turns out that my oldest brother is an alcoholic and has been sober in AA for 35 years now. I didn't know that at the time. He's much older than I am, and we didn't grow up in the same house, but my dad had been to Al-Anon, and I didn't know that. So I called home from this payphone, like crying, hysterical, telling my dad that I woke up missing clothes in an alley in Cuernavaca. I mean, how would most fathers react to that? But my father, he's an odd man in many ways, but I'll give him that he said the most perfect thing to me on the phone that day. He said, you know, I'm glad you told me The most important thing is that you don't waste any time being ashamed, and that you just as quickly as you can get yourself back to New York so we can get you some help. And I remember saying to him on the phone, I was like, I feel like there is a monster living inside of me, and I don't know how to keep it from coming out, but I think it has something to do with liquor. You know, I was like, I feel like there's this crazy wild beast, and it just comes out, and I do things that I don't understand and that I don't like about myself, but I think it has to do with alcohol. So I vowed to not drink. 2 hours later, by 1 p.m. that day, I couldn't take it anymore because I was really physically addicted to liquor at that point. I mean, it was no longer just the desire to escape myself. I couldn't live without liquor, so I was shaking, and at 1 p.m. I was in the bar called El Bohemio, and I asked the Mexican bartenders if they would make me a White Russian. I didn't know how, and so I got behind the bar and I made it because I thought the cream would make it go down better, because I'd been trying to drink this shot of bourbon for 45 minutes and I couldn't get it into my mouth because I was shaking and I was heaving and I was wretched. And it was like, I mean, it's a really gross, visceral description, but I say it because that was my first moment of powerlessness that I ever talked to a sponsor about. So I came into AA when I got back from Mexico. I went to meetings. I didn't like them. I didn't buy a big book. I didn't call the women who gave me their phone numbers. I called men who gave me their phone numbers. I went out on a lot of dates with like a lot of much older men who'd been sober for a very long time who were wildly inappropriate. And, you know, really, unfortunately, though there's no law against it, you know, it's a real shame, I think, when we prey upon the weak in AA. I think it's, and it has nothing to do with like the laws or the rules or, and to be honest, a lot of people waited until I was exactly 1 year sober. I actually had somebody at my home group approach me and say, hey, I know you have an anniversary coming up next week. You're going to be a year. I'd like to make a date with you so that I get to take you out after you're sober. And you could think that that was charming, but I'm talking about this because safety in AA is actually a really big topic at GSB right now, and people don't talk about it enough. People don't talk about enough how young women are preyed upon in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous at times. And I'd just like to give a little shout out to how, at the time, I had no idea who I was. I had no idea what was important to me. And I was very vulnerable, and I liked male attention, and I liked older male attention. I liked to feel special and pretty and important. And even though I had some time sober, I would say until I was 5 years sober and in my mid-20s, or at that time, sorry, in my late 20s, early almost 30, when I actually was 5 years sober, like I didn't even know why I needed that attention. It was like a sick addiction until I had worked the steps long enough to give up the obsession with being noticed. And so being noticed in that way by people in the rooms of AA who I thought had gone before me, and I thought they must know something magical about staying sober. So if they're hitting on me, it must be for some spiritual ideal that they know more about than like I do. But really, it was just a sad, sad waste of time and created a lot of damage and mistrust and negative energy for me. And so it's a real bummer when that happens. So a lot of time got wasted with that. I did not stay sober. I had big resentments at AA for the way I had been treated by men, and I had not done the work. I had not worked with a sponsor, so I had no support to ride that out and stay sober. I don't blame anyone for that. The problem is that I had no support network. I wasn't talking to any women. I wasn't doing the work. So I started drinking again. And when I came back in 2005, I don't even know that I was as sick in terms of my alcoholism. Like, it hadn't gotten quite as bad as it had been previous, but I hit a new spiritual bottom where even though I was like capable of holding down food and I was halfway through college and I really deeply hated myself. My life was just in this sad repetition. I was living in what I call the codependent basement of hell with my boyfriend at the time. We were just throw blenders at each other and scream and take turns getting drunk, and I would barely show up to class. And it was like life had given me these beautiful bouquets of opportunities and experiences to take advantage of, and I was just too kind of like flatlining to see it at any point. I really couldn't like access any of the opportunities that life was offering me because I was just living in a half blacked out state of emotional numbness of like reaching for alcohol, reaching for drugs, reaching to feel something other than the moment. And so when I came back to AA, I was just desperate. They say, people say all the time, I didn't come to AA to be a better person. I came to AA because I was going to die if I didn't stop drinking. The first time I came to AA, I came because I was going to die if I didn't stop drinking. The second time I came to AA, I came because I wanted to be a better person. I felt like I felt like I was a sick, disgusting human being with this like half reliance on white knuckling it when I felt I needed to, and half reliance on alcohol when I couldn't take it anymore. And it was a sad existence. And so I came back in and I wanted to do the work. And I picked a sponsor right away. And I saw this, I heard people say, I remember from before, they said, pick someone who has what you want. I didn't really know what that meant, but I saw that my home group was Oxford, the Oxford group on 84th Street, bright, shiny meeting, a lot of sobriety, a lot of people living like sturdy, stable lives. And I saw, thank you, I saw this woman. She walked in every week. She came to the business meeting. She sat in the front row. She wore these outfits. And I was just like, that lady looks like she pays her Con Ed bill on time. You know? And like, I couldn't do that. I had stacks of unopened mail and bills. I couldn't figure out how to write a check. I just was like so confused about like handling the details of life. And I never had to. I just kind of coasted through all of it. And so I asked her to be my sponsor, and we started working together once a week for like an hour and a half once a week in her office. And right away she asked me to, you know, she asked me to do the first step, and we talked about that moment in Mexico, and I was like, that's real powerlessness, that I was desperate to stop drinking, and I was also desperate to like pour liquor down my, it was just this horrible battle. So that was my first step, and we talked about that, and I admitted that I was powerless. Then she asked me to do the second step. She asked me to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I have to be honest, I don't know that I ever heard the restore me to sanity part until I was like 7 years sober. But it's okay. It takes a while. Like, I love to reread the literature. I love to go to step meetings to hear it again, to hear it from other people's perspectives. I love to do the steps over and over again because I learn new things every time. But at the time, I heard that a power greater than believe in a power greater than myself. That's all I heard. I didn't really think about it restoring me to sanity yet. But that also, it wasn't hard for me. People come to AA and they get really, there's a lot of talk in the rooms about a frustration that you, about the word God. And it was uncomfortable for me when I came here. I was not raised religious. I'm not a religious person today. I don't have a Judeo-Christian concept of a higher power. I don't. And I talk about this specifically because for a long time I thought I had to pretend that I did. I think everybody's beliefs are beautiful and important. And it was so important to me when I finally learned that I didn't have to pretend to believe in something that I didn't actually believe in. But it was not hard for me to think about a power greater than myself. Because I'd had a series of big spiritual experiences in my life in nature. I'd had like this incredible experience in the Himalayas when I was 17. I had like the opportunity to hike through the Tibetan Himalayas. And I remember when she asked me to do that, I thought back to like being in this wild, huge mountain range. And I remember crying in this mountain range when I was a teenager, because I'd grown up in New York City and I thought I knew everything and I thought I was at the center of the universe, and I was in these huge mountains, and we woke up one morning like deep in the crevice of a valley of these enormous mountains at 22,000 feet, and I saw the clouds rise up over these mountaintops, and I said for the first, I just bawled, and I was like, holy shit, I'm so small. And I didn't know until then, because I thought I was so important because I grew up in New York City. But I was like, I'm so small, and there's all this stuff happening that I have no control over, and it's so much bigger than me, and it has nothing to do with an anthropomorphized character. It just had to do with that I felt very comfortable with the concept that like the natural world was much larger and higher functioning than I was, and I was comfortable with that, and I worked with that higher power all these years, and it works for me. And she asked me to do the third step and turn my will and my life over the care of that higher power. It was complicated. I didn't know what that meant. She asked me to just sit, find a place to sit for an hour every day and try to meditate. I had to have headphones in all the time because the shame that I felt about the way I lived my life up until that point was overwhelming. I actually couldn't be in my own head with quiet at all, ever. So I would go to the park and I had headphones in all the time, and I would take them out for like 30 seconds at a time. And slowly over the months, as I counted days, which was excruciating, by the way, counting days was excruciating, thank you, I would take them out 30 seconds, a minute,
2 minutes, 5 minutes, and I could eventually, I got to a point where I could really just sit with myself, you know? I only have a minute left, but I'm gonna say that, oh man, I spent so much more time talking about everything in the past, of course, than I wanted to, but I'm gonna say in my last minute maybe too that she took me through all of the steps. Doing amends to my family was incredibly complicated because so much of what happened drinking happened before I was like 16 years old. And it was very complicated. How do I make amends to people who I felt were actually responsible for me and failed me in a time period where they were supposed to be taking care of me? And how that's panned out for the first 10 years, it was living amends. I showed up for things. I helped people when they were sick. I helped I showed up for every single one of my siblings' kids being born, soccer games. I became a member of my family in a way that I had not been before. Now that I'm almost 12 years sober, my ideas about amends are a little different, and I'm working up to some formal apologies, not because they're necessarily waiting for them, but because at this point, there's gunk inside of me that will completely free me if I let it go and I like do a formal amends for things. Like, the amends process with my family is transformative, and with everybody, all the people I did amends to, it had nothing to do with letting them know that I was wrong. It had to do with freeing myself from my fear of my past. So doing that was extraordinary. I have no time left. I just want to put a quick shout out in for doing service in AA. Over the past 11 plus years, I've been able to work in jails, hospitals, you know, meetings, working with others, sponsors. It's been extraordinary. If you're confused and not sure if you like AA or not, I would put yourself smack in the middle of it and get as many service commitments as you possibly can, because it's been magical and transformative to work with other people suffering from this disease in like all sorts of ways. And it makes me love AA more and more every day. And the friendships I've been able to create while staying sober have become the most important of my life. And so today I get to be exactly the woman that I choose to be in the world. I no longer wake up seized by fear about how I'll be perceived. I no longer go to sleep totally paranoid about like how I spent the day in a complete Tasmanian devil style stupor of not being able to control myself. When I came here, I didn't know how to look other people in the eye and listen and care about who they were and what they were saying. All I could hear is the noise in my head. And today, I have the most important gift I've been given in AA is the ability to quietly look into a fellow's eyes, a fellow AA, friends, you know, anybody, and just take in who they are and what they're offering and sit with it peacefully and care about another person. I was too self-centered and damaged to care about another person when I came here. And that is like the greatest gift that AA has given me. So thanks.